Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome back to the Corbett Report podcast. I'm your host, James Corbett of CorbettReport.com, coming to you in June of 2024 with another edition of Questions for Corbett, that regular series where, usually, you send in a question and I provide an answer. But today we're going to do things a little bit differently. As longtime viewers of the Questions for Corbett series might remember, back in the day, I used to answer a dozen or more questions each episode. But I switched to a one question and one answer per episode format because I think it's better to do a deep dive to really sink my teeth into an issue. Having said that, for whatever reason, none of the questions that I've received lately have tickled my fancy in quite the right way for me to want to do an entire podcast episode deep dive on any particular question. That's no slight against the questions I'm receiving. It's just sometimes I feel like I have something to really dig into. And other times I don't, and this is one of those times. But I still want to do Questions for Corbett, and I still want to answer your questions. So let's return to the classic format. Just for this one episode, I'm going to try to answer a bunch of questions. And let's see how it goes. We'll start with an email that I received from Scott, who writes, I was just wondering when/if there was still going to be a follow-up to the World War I conspiracy documentary. Truly intriguing stuff. Thank you for that, Scott. Yes, to answer your question, if? Question mark? Yes. When? Question mark? I'll just say stay tuned. That is all I will say for now. All right, and Scott continues, as you have mentioned earlier, the dates for wars are different depending on which country you reside in. Period. That being said, do you consider that World War III may well have started back in 2014 from Ukraine's point of view? Thank you for the question, Scott. To clarify, I don't believe I have said that the dates for wars are different depending on which country you reside in. Or at any rate, that isn't what I intended to say exactly. I have talked a few times now about the idea of starting the clock on any given conflict, and where you start the clock will influence, greatly influence, perhaps even determine what you think about that conflict and how you think about it. So I've talked about that in reference to the Ukraine-Russia conflict and Israel-Palestine and the Rwandan genocide most recently. So I think there is a difference there. But to answer your question, I certainly have said that World War III, in the fifth generation warfare sense, the reference there is to your guide to fifth generation warfare at corbettreport.com/fifth gen, if you haven't checked it out yet. That form of World War III, the war of every nation against its own citizens in the bio war and the info war and the economic war, etc., that is already underway. But to answer the spirit of your question, the actual hot kinetic military conflict in the sense that we think of World War I and World War II, that World War III has not yet started, but it is coming into view. And I have talked about that before, so I'll provide some references to that. In fact, if you're interested in some references, let's go to the next email, this one from Mick, or is it Mike? I don't know how to pronounce those three letters. Really curious to know your opinion about the, brackets, inevitable World War III. Teams, duration, and results. Well, you're in luck, Mick or Mike, because not only will I have more to say about that in the future, I have already said quite a bit about that subject. So, as always, the search bar is your friend, so let's go to CorbettReport.com, and we will type in the magic word here is WWIII, not WW numeral 3. Who writes it like that? No, the World Wars are WWI. WWII and WWIII. That's the way to search it on my site anyway. I have had that feedback before. I can't find the World War I conspiracy theory anywhere. Well, actually, I will show you a few different ways that you can access that at the end, towards the end of this episode, so stay tuned for that. But, yes, for the purposes of searching on my site, please use the I, the Roman numeral I, as your search friend. So, in this case, WWIII. And when we type that into the search bar and we click search, we're going to get a list of things that I have done on this in the past. Various conversations I've had, for example, this conversation with Charlie Robinson of the Macro Aggressions podcast, I think is worth your time and attention. It's called the World War III Script. It was recorded last July, about a year ago. I think it's highly relevant to this question. How will World War III be fought? Which not only talks about the technical mechanics of that hot kinetic military war, World War III, but also the 5GW sense of World War III, and many other conversations I've had besides, and you can keep following the older entries back if you want to keep going back into the archives. There's a lot there. So I hope that helps answer that question. Let's move on to an email from Brandon, who writes, I write today about Robert F. Kennedy Jr., and I deeply wonder your thoughts about him. I've got to say, I find him very inspiring. I listened to your interview with him after the real Anthony Fauci was released, and it would have been hard to argue at that time that he was anything other than sincere in his concerns of Fauci the man, the vaccines, the lockdowns, etc. Now that he is well into his presidential campaign, and the more I listen to alternative media, such as The Corbett Report, America Unplugged, I Protest with Donald Jeffries, etc., I can't help but wonder, am I being duped? All right. Thank you for the question, Brandon. Let me reiterate, not for the first time, probably not for the last, I am a Canadian living in Japan and an anarchist. So I cannot for the life of me wonder, help but wonder why people are so interested in my take on the American selection sideshow circus. There are many reasons for me not to, either not to have an opinion or for you not to care about that opinion. But anyway, all right, let me put on record the one and only thing I will say about this distraction sideshow circus. Are you being duped? Sure. By RFK Jr., as well as every other candidate, every other person who presumes to be able to come in and run the country and all of that other nonsense that we know to be demonstrable nonsense because political power is not invested, is not vested in the Oval Office. It is wielded from behind the scenes by the structure of the deep state, which is part of the much broader structure, which to a certain extent is everything I've been talking about for 17 years. And the resident of the Oval Office matters not one whit with regard to that, even if government really existed, even if there was it wasn't simply a superstition that people tend to believe in, a mass hallucination, as it were. But anyway, having said all of that, yes, I mean, as one example of that, one way of illustrating that, why don't you go ask the major candidates in this race what they think about, oh, say, Israel and America's support for Israel? Let's see how much of a difference your vote is going to make on November whatever it is. In fact, let me use this as an opportunity to highlight Derek Brose getting the chance to actually put that question to RFK Jr. about his support for Israel. Very interesting moment. So I'll throw that in the show notes if you haven't seen that yet. But yeah, you're being duped. And not just by RFK Jr., by every single participant in this distractionary sideshow circus that will determine nothing. And that is the only thing I have to say about this stupid event that means nothing, that decides nothing. This is the least important selection of your lifetime. But hey, I'm a Canadian in Japan and an anarchist. Pfft, what do I know? All right. Let's move on to an email from Dewin. Dewin? Maybe it's Germanic. Devin. I don't know. I am concerned about news I've seen concerning nationwide protests against Israel here in the States. One example by Zero Hedge, and then he links to an article on Zero Hedge, are pro-Palestinian protests being hijacked by Marxists to destroy capitalism, freedom, and democracy? An intriguing leading question in that headline. And Dewin goes on to say, these various articles suggest that these protests are being funded by Soros organizations and have plants similar to the Antifa and BLM protests back in 2020. Is there truth to this? And if so, to what end? I saw another piece that claims they are specifically targeting high trade areas to affect the economy. Is this merely a destabilization tactic, or is it deeper? Secondly, if this is true, does this take away from their protests? I know there were a lot of well-meaning people that peacefully protested during BLM that weren't plants and were legitimately there to support their cause. Is this a similar situation? Do I have this all wrong? I don't support anything Israel is doing to Palestine, and it gives me hope to see something that looks like the anti-war protests from the Vietnam era. Am I blindly still supporting the bad guys? I appreciate your answer. All right, thank you for the question, Dewin. This is an important question, and I'm sure you're not the only person that has it. But I would point to your own statement, what you wrote there in your own words. I think that the statement, I don't support anything Israel is doing to Palestine seems to me to be the core of the issue. And whether or not you are right or wrong in that assessment, that sounds like an assessment that is core to what you believe about this issue. And again, I don't know you, but I would assume that people, thoughtful people in the Corbett Report audience, have probably put thought into what they believe, what they really know to be true, what they believe to be true, what they know to be right and wrong, and have examined this from various sources and various sides and come to their conclusion about this. And whatever your conclusion is, I'm not here to opine on that. But if you come to the conclusion, I don't support anything Israel is doing to Palestine, then it seems to me that is the crux of the issue. That is what you believe. That is where you stand on this issue. And I would suggest it does not help to pollute that concrete moral stance that you have with the mental gymnastics game of, oh, but wait, what if the they, them, those are trying to make me believe that so that they can get this out of this agenda over here in some other way? So, I better do the mental gymnastics backflip of then believing what I don't actually believe to be true so that then I can stick it to the man, right? Because I understand the mental gymnastics that go on with that type of game and I can play them as well as anyone, but I also know that that is the never-ending funhouse hall of mirrors. Because you could then play the double backflip. Because, oh, but what if the Soroses and the they, them, those are trying to make you believe that what they are doing is funding, they're broadcasting, they're funding these protests so that you will then start supporting Israel, even though you don't actually support Israel. And maybe that's their intention all along. Ha ha. But wait, what if no? They know that you're going to know that they're broadcasting their intent so that you're going to not support Israel in the way that you... Again, as I say, you could play that game forever. There is no end to the mental gymnastics game. I think it's much simpler to know what you believe. Find the bedrock. And maybe that in and of itself is the biggest part of all of this. What is the bedrock? Examine different sources. Interrogate your assumptions. Come to your conclusion. But once you have a conclusion based on your moral principles, what you know to be right and wrong, that should be the basis from which you act. Now, how do you proceed with that? Do you then start to join these protests? Well, maybe that's a completely different calculus. Okay, well, I know what I believe and I know where I stand. Now, what do I do with that? And again, obviously, that's your conclusion to come to in the way that you want to support or not support or partake in or completely ignore or whatever with regards to the wider protest movement. But the point is that you know where you stand and you know what you believe, because otherwise it's just trying to base it on what other people, what you think other people are trying to make you believe and blah, blah, blah. And as I say, that's a game you can never stop playing. So having said all of that, I think, yeah, okay, great. Let's come to examinations of various potential protest movements and where the funding is coming from and all of that. But at the bottom line, at the very end of the day, either you know what you believe on this subject in terms of right and wrong and moral and immoral, or you don't. And if you don't, that's fine. That just means you have more work to do in terms of searching for sources and finding information and coming to that conclusion. Anyway, that's generally what I would say about that. Your duty is to know where you stand on issues of genocide and war crimes, etc., not to think about what other people are doing with regards to that. And let's, as you say, let's put it in the context of, say, the Vietnam era anti-war protests. You know, those dumb, dirty hippies, those lefty commie people are the ones protesting against the Vietnam War. Therefore, the Vietnam War must be good. Yay, Nixon! is that what we should conclude from that? It doesn't seem right, does it? So anyway, a lot to think about there, but I hope I've made my point. Let's move on to the next email, this one coming from Sherry, who writes, James, a friend in Alaska told me that BlackRock owns 75% of the merchandise inside her neighborhood's Safeway, and also the U-Scan auto checkout machines. Safeway employs a limited number of cashiers and only owns the remaining merchandise. Can this be possible? Are they buying our food supply channels as well as sweeping up houses to rent to people? Okay, good question, Sherry. Thank you for sharing that. Again, I'm sure a lot of people have a question along these lines, because where can you go in the economy that isn't at least partially owned by BlackRock? But what does that really mean? Well, I can go you one step deeper, because not only, as you point out, do they own 75% of the merchandise inside the Safeway, but they own Safeway. to get to the point, what is Safeway and who really owns it? This article from Sporked from last year, which notes that Safeway was sold to Albertsons in 2015, and that Albertsons was purchased by Kroger in 2022, and who owns Kroger? The top three shareholders in Kroger are the Vanguard Group, BlackRock, and Berkshire Hathaway. So even the store itself is owned, at least partially, by BlackRock. But then, as you point out, the merchandise inside the store, what is sold in the supermarket, no matter how many brands you see in those ultra-processed foods in the middle part of the supermarket, well, go down the aisle, there are all these different brands. They must be all different companies, right? Well, as conspiracy realists know by now, and if you don't, you should look it up, all of those different brands are just different labels, and there are really a handful of big food conglomerates that own all of those different consumer-facing brands. So, and when you look back at the ownership of the various big food conglomerates, I haven't done a deep dive on each and every one of them, but I'm gonna guess. I'm just gonna go on a limb and say BlackRock is a majority or a large shareholder in each and every one of those big food giants. So, anyway, the point stands. Yes, BlackRock seems to own everything. Not just the merchandise inside Safeway, but Safeway itself. But what does that mean? What does that actually mean? Does that mean Larry Fink is going around saying, okay, Safeway, you must stock this food, and this food company, you must make, you must put this ingredient in your Oreos or whatever? No, I don't think, I mean, that's the cartoon villain version of this. Does Larry Fink, the CEO of BlackRock, does he own these companies that BlackRock happens to be a large, if not majority, at least large shareholder in? Well, not really, not in the straightforward sense. No, what does it mean? What does it mean that BlackRock owns all of these companies, or at least has an investment in them? Well, if you are interested in that question, that is exactly what I gestured to at the end of my How BlackRock Conquered the World documentary. You'll remember that I talked about, and then I published, a follow-up editorial on how Vanguard conquered the world. And if you go to that How Vanguard Conquered the World, it talks about the Vanguard Group, which, as I note, was in all of those images I show of the top institutional shareholders of all these mega corporations. It almost invariably, number one was Vanguard, number two was BlackRock, number three was State Street, over and over and over again. So who's the Vanguard Group? Well, I wrote How Vanguard Conquered the World to talk about that. But in that, I also address the question of ownership and what it means in this case for these ETFs and index-linked funds to be invested as the major shareholders in these companies. What does that mean? Is that ownership in the straightforward sense? The actualies of the fact-checkers would love for you to go start spreading half-truths about this, because then they can come and debunk your straw-man argument. And yay, you see, we know. So anyway, if you want to know the real meaning of that, I would suggest check out that editorial, How Vanguard Conquered the World. Having said that, yes, there's no doubt that there is a problem with the food supply system, and regardless of the ownership of that, those conglomerates and all of that, still, there's obviously a demonstrable problem with the processed gunk that is in the food supply already, let alone the crazy bioengineered, amazing, I can't believe it's not food garbage of the future that is about to, and in some cases already, starting to fill your gullet. So if you want to know more about that problem, what it is we're facing, the nature of that problem, you can, of course, check out my recent episode 460 of the Corbett Report on the future of food. I think it's an incredibly important presentation, and there's a lot of info in there with, as usual, dozens and dozens and dozens, hundreds of links to various sources of information on that. But more importantly than the problem itself is the answer to that problem, the solution. So you'll want to check out my recent Solutions Watch on regenerative agriculture. You'll want to check out my 2013 recently flashbacked video on how to boycott big food. You want to check out my 2015 presentation on solutions, guerrilla gardening. You want to check out my Solutions Watch from last year on community gardening, et cetera, et cetera. Those are just four examples of things we can do about this, regardless of whether Larry Fink is personally commanding each big food company what ingredients to put in their food or not. So thank you for the question, Sherry, and thank you for letting me put that on the record. Let's move on to a comment. A comment that comes from Diotica, who on How Vanguard Conquered... No, sorry. On How BlackRock Conquered the World, Part 3, Aladdin's Genie and the Future of the World, which was the editorial, the third part of the editorial, upon which my How BlackRock Conquered the World documentary was based. Diotica recently left a comment that to the effect of, what happened to the image under... But that raises a further question. Who owns BlackRock? As I'd like to know what the answer was. Okay, thank you for that question, Diotica. I will note, as I record this, at the time I am recording this, for some reason, some of the images in this article aren't showing up. Where did they go? This is a good question. I don't know what happened with that. I will fix it by the time you're actually watching this edition of Questions for Corbett. But as it stands right now, yeah, who owns BlackRock? And then there's this image. Well, what does it say? Oh my God, how will I ever figure it out? Okay, well, in the interest of give a man a fish and feed him for a day, teach a man to fish and feed him for a lifetime, I will show you how you can go about finding the answer to this question. What does this say? Because this is not something you have to rely on me or some other, you know, figure from Mount Olympus to come down from on high to tell you. You can look it up for yourself. And there are many ways you can do that. I will suggest, in this case, a very simple resource, finance.yahoo.com. Why not? Doesn't matter. There's many different sources like this. And in this case, if you happen to know the ticker of BlackRock, it's BLK, but if you don't know that, you can just type in BlackRock and find BLK. But they have many different funds, so make sure you're getting the actual BlackRock. But there you go, BlackRock Inc., BLK, and there's the stock price, and there's the historical, you know, the volume, trades, et cetera, the price over time. But let's go down to holders, as in holders of shares. And percent of shares held by all insider, percent of shares held by institutions, percent of float held by institutions, etc. And if you go down to top institutional holders, you will find who are the majority or the largest shareholders of BlackRock. Number one, Vanguard Group. Number two, BlackRock. Number three, State Street. Exactly as in almost every other example that I was showing in that How BlackRock Conquered the World editorial slash documentary. So there you go. Anyway, point being, you can look this up for yourself, and you could do that with any number of companies. Okay, let's move on to an email from Jay, who writes, "Hello." Hello, Jay. "In your 9/11 suspects documentary, you mentioned prominent suspects in the 9/11 plot, such as Dick Cheney, Donald Rumsfeld, Larry Silverstein, Dov Zakheim, Paul Bremer, and Richard Armitage. But you do not explain how they are suspects. Do you have any videos that discuss the roles these people may have played in the 9/11 plot, especially Paul Bremer and Richard Armitage?" Yes. Yes, I do. So if you go way back in the archives, I did a series of videos way back in the day, and I can't even remember what they were called. Something along the lines of what happened on 9/11. And I did one specifically on Dick Cheney, going through where he was and all of that. And I did one on Donald Rumsfeld. So that is somewhere back in the archives, but that was way, 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 way back in the day. I'll dig it up if I can and put it in the show notes. But anyway, it's there. Larry Silverstein, for example, I talked at length in 9/11 Trillions about Silverstein and Dov Zakheim. Paul Bremer and Richard Armitage, you ask about in particular. So let's look them up. Again, search bar is your friend. Type in Bremer into my search engine and hit the search bar, and you will find the number of times that I've talked about Bremer, for example, in False Flags Q&A specifically. All right, cool. But probably in the False Flags documentary as well, and some other publications, for example, 9/11 Suspects. But I will direct your attention to 9/11 Trillions, in which, if you click into that, and obviously, like with all my other documentaries, here's the hyperlink transcript, absolutely every word of the documentary, and hyperlinks to the sources of information. And let's just do a find search for Bremer. And there you go. Okay, so there's this section on, at the time of 9/11, Marsh's chief of risk management was Paul Bremer. And he was, on the morning of 9/11, not at his office and Marshall McLennan getting killed with all of his co-workers. No, he was in NBC's TV studio, where he just happened to be delivering the official story of the 9/11 attack before it was even the official story. And I have the actual clip there in the documentary. I have the link to the clip if you want to watch it in its context. So there's some information about Bremer just off the top of my head, or my website's head. And similarly, let's see, Armitage. I don't have a lot on Richard Armitage, but I have mentioned him, as you say, in the 9/11 Suspects documentary and some other places besides. But I will direct your attention way back to a 2013 podcast I did on who was really behind the 9/11 attacks. And again, if you do a search for Armitage, you'll see I linked up a series of articles on Richard Armitage talking about his connections. And there's the time reference into this podcast, so if you're listening to the podcast itself, you can listen in at 34-minute mark or thereabouts for the context of this series of articles, and there's the link. Anyway, those are some places you can start with regards to those figures. Let's move on to email from Roy, who writes, "Sorry to bother you, but I've been debating with a niece of mine over whether NPR sucks or not, with me saying it does and her saying it's better than alt media sources because it has a larger international staff." I said so does Reuters, in spades, and I hope she doesn't think they're reliable, but maybe she does. "Looking for evidence that NPR sucks, which I know is not lacking, I tried the search function on your site and was impressed by it." Oh, good. "Anyway, I searched on NPR and went back without finding anything specifically about it to September 2020, when I got caught up by the 9/11 Suspects, which I never watched, but I'm doing so now. Awesome. I seem to have largely forgotten about Giuliani. How could I have ever held any hope in anyone connected with him?" Good question. Hopium, even. "While I'm doing that, I wonder, one, if you've ever done a piece about NPR, and two, if NPR is individually covered in your media course, which I could try to get my sisters and niece to take along with me, but they probably wouldn't, even though we'd all learn something and they really need it." Okay, thank you for that question, Roy. And thank you, yes, for people who don't know, my Mass Media History online course is a 5.5-hour, three-lesson deep dive into mass media, the development and rise of mass media and the way it's shaping our world and where it's going from here. And there's transcripts and reading lists and study questions and all sorts of things and goodies in there. It is truly worth your time and attention if you were at all interested in the subject of media. I think there's a lot of info in there. So thank you for mentioning that. But having said that, there's nothing specifically on NPR in that course. It's not so much about the individual companies. It's not. I do talk about, for example, CBS's William Paley and his connection to the intelligence agencies and things like that, but it's not so much about that. But yes, I think you and your sister, niece, whatever, I think they would benefit from that. And I think it's fairly normie friendly. It's not woo, spooky, conspiracy, crazy, alt-media, weirdo stuff. It's very, very mainline history for the most part, but hopefully philosophically intriguing for those who are inclined to that way. Anyway, having said all of that, no, that doesn't cover NPR specifically, so don't buy it for that reason. And I will once again pull out the Canadian in Japan card to say, no, I've never done a specific deep dive on NPR in America, which I never had growing up in Canada, so I don't have much connection to NPR per se. Having said that, I have talked about it in various connections and looked at some of its propaganda, most recently in the most recent edition of the, not defunct, but largely dormant, Propaganda Watch series, Eat Ze Bugs or You're Racist, which I hope you remember from earlier this year. If not, check it out. I think it's a pretty good exploration of a pretty ridiculous piece of NPR propaganda from the Code Switch podcast, talking about, yes, Eat Ze Bugs or You're a Racist, which is, of course, as people who subject themselves to NPR know at this point, is pretty much all they ever talk about. So anyway, I thought that was a good presentation, but no, not so much about NPR itself, more so about that particular piece of propaganda. But having said that, I will note there was a spate of information that came out earlier this year about NPR. Specifically in April, there was a bunch of stories, and we'll take this from Zero Hedge, why not? An open-minded spirit no longer exists within NPR. says NPR veteran who excoriates outlet over Hunter Russiagate activism. So that was Yuri Berliner, a longtime 25-year NPR veteran who came out earlier this year to criticize the organization, talk about its partisan hackery, and guess what the inevitable follow-up to that was? Punished NPR journalist resigns after calling out partisan train wreck. Yes, that's right. So shortly after that was published, he was getting sidelined within NPR and ultimately ended up throwing in the towel. So there you go. No surprise there, perhaps. But then we heard this. New NPR CEO gave TED Talk asserting truth is a distraction. Sounds about right. Truth is just getting in the way of getting things done. Indeed. Well, comforting lies. All right. So anyway, there's that information that came out, and then there's this op-ed piece, NPR scandal should kill taxpayer-funded broadcasting, that goes into some degree of detail about the NPR scandal in particular, how it's funded, why it shouldn't be funded, etc. So there's a lot of information out there. I haven't done the NPR deep dive in particular. As I say, as a Canadian in Japan, I don't know if this is really something I want to devote myself to. I could. Maybe I will. But actually, now that you mention it, now that you bring it up, I think a deep dive would be in order into CBC. That is something that I think I could sink my teeth into. In the meantime, if you want something along those lines, you might want to flash back to my 2013 podcast on the BBC Exposed, where I talked about the Big Brother Corporation, I mean the British Broadcasting Corporation. So anyway, sorry, I don't have anything specifically on NPR at this point. Email from Arthur, who writes, I have a running argument with a former colleague who disagrees with anything challenging mainstream norms. I mentioned to her that the conspiracy theory term, was originated by the CIA to ridicule those who dissented the official lone nut job gunman. I don't know how to say that all of a sudden. Can I speak English? Lone nut job gunman, as to how JFK died. I tried searching your site for that assertion, but can't find it. She considers herself a scholar, sticks to the books type person. I would love to provide evidence that this was so. Can you give the links to that information? Yes, Arthur, I can. Thank you for asking the question. It's something that I've covered quite a bit over the years, but always good to put it on the record yet again, because there's always people who didn't catch the reference. In this case, there are the magic words are actually magic numbers, and the numbers are 1035-960. Type that into my search bar, and you will get the various times that I've talked about the specific CIA dispatch, number 1035-960, that did talk about conspiracy theorizing in its relation to the Warren criticism of the Warren Commission report. And so I've talked about it many, many times. I'll throw a couple of specific references here to you. One is episode 50 of the Corbett Report podcast, first released back in July of 2008, 16 years ago. It's an hour-long, 50-minute-long exploration of that term conspiracy theory and how it became weaponized, etc. Of course, I do talk about 1035-960 in that exploration. I'll also direct you, maybe not for your scholarly friend, but for Normie McNormison, I Am a Conspiracy Theorist was a good short, punchy video I put out a while ago that talks, for example, does, of course, mention CIA Dispatch 1035-960, and there it is in the show notes. As always, you can click on it and go read the document for yourself. Do not take my word for it or anyone else's. This is what the document actually says, and here's the context of it, etc. So there's the actual link to the document, and I hope that's of use to you, but I will throw in this proviso, because even the way you phrased it there, I mentioned to her that the conspiracy theory term was originated by the CIA. When you put it that way, you're going to get the fact checker, actually, who's going to come back and tell you, oh, no, the CIA didn't invent the term conspiracy theory. Problem solved. You've been debunked. Now I can go on with my life. Doesn't matter. I win. That is the game the fact checkers will play. As usual, they set up a straw man, push over the straw man, and then say that they've won. Wow. Stunning and brave. No, of course, the claim is not that the CIA literally invented the collocation of those words, conspiracy and theory, or conspiracy and theorist, or conspiracy and theorizing. No, those words existed before the CIA came along in the 1960s with CIA Dispatch 1035-960, and you can find examples of it from the 1890s or whatever people have dug up. See? It wasn't originated by the CIA. No, that is not the claim. The claim is that from the point of CIA Dispatch 1035-960 onward, the weaponization of that phrase, conspiracy theory, conspiracy theorist, was cemented in the minds of the public through the media assets that the CIA was running, to which this dispatch was addressed, which, of course, came out in the Church Committee hearings, Operation Mockingbird, as it is known, although that isn't what it was actually called. But anyway, the CIA's ties to media assets and friendly people in the media who would deliver CIA propaganda picked up on and started using this term, conspiracy theory, as a way of, as a pejorative, as a way of debunking or sidelining, mocking any criticism of any official government explanation. This is where that practice became cemented in the minds of the public, because as I've pointed out many, many times before, conspiracy theory, conspiracy theorists, conspiracy theorizing is a neutral term. It has a straight denotative meaning of, well, I mean, for example, a police detective is a conspiracy theorist by nature, theorizing about a conspiracy that may or may not have taken place with regards to a specific crime. It, you know, it's not a bad thing, but it has become an object of ridicule in the minds of the public because of this CIA memo that fed this idea, this term, which was then picked up on and used in the media, which then filtered down to the public, the brainwashed, propagandized public. That is the method of transmission of this as an idea. And there are other people, I've heard the claim that people did the LexisNexis database search and found the use of the term conspiracy theory or conspiracy theorist as a pejorative took off after the point of this CIA dispatch in the 1960s. I don't have LexisNexis. I haven't done that search in particular, so take that anecdote for what it's worth. I'd be very interested if someone could actually put numbers to that figure. But anyway, I think the point still stands. Before the 1960s, you never really heard conspiracy theorist as a term that was particularly of relevance or interest, or certainly not a term that was used to degrade and mock people. After the 1960s, after it got seeded into the public consciousness, that's when it became weaponized. Anyway, follow the links in the show notes if you're interested in hearing and reading more about that. But let's move on to the next email, this one from Cheryl, who writes, regarding interview 1885, whistleblower reveals U.S. cover-up of Israeli war crimes. New World Next Week, number 557. Who is Blinken? I see his father was a bankster. You mentioned another name on the show, but I couldn't understand what the name was. Okay, good question. Actually, who is Blinken? Maybe one of those types of deep dive questions that I could do an entire episode on. I'm not sure I will, but who is Blinken? Sure. Anyway, that's a good question. I won't get into the depths of that right now, but the other part of your question, there was another name mentioned that I didn't catch. Who was that name? Good question. And again, you don't have to rely on emailing me to find out, or at least not always. If there is something like that you don't catch, hopefully you know by now that the Corbett Report now comes with captions, because I talked about that a while back. And as I explained in this video, Substack has started auto-transcribing my podcasts, so there is an automatic machine-generated transcript for everything that I do. Of course, I don't verify 100% accuracy, but it's creepily accurate. It really is. And so let's test it out in this case. Let's do it live. Here is interview 1885 that Cheryl is talking about. And here is the link to Substack. So if we click on that, it will bring it up and start playing this edition of New World Next Week. And if we turn the CC, the closed caption, on, you'll see, yes, you can read along as we are hearing about the various stories. But let's go to the transcript and cut to the chase. The State Department under Anthony Blinken, of course, with longtime family connections to the Glenn Maxwell family. That was who James Evan Pilato was referencing there in regards to Anthony Blinken. If you didn't catch the name, there it is. And I hope you do know Glenn Maxwell. If not, search that name on Corbett Report, on Media Monarchy, on the web generally, and some questions may be answered from that, and then put Glenn Maxwell and Blinken together and see how those terms connect. But anyway, if you ever do have a question like that, who, what did you say? I didn't catch that. This might be a good place to start. As I say, I cannot verify or guarantee accuracy of every single thing that's on here, but it is creepily accurate most of the time. Anyway, so there you go. I hope that helps. And finally, one more. Let's go to an email from John, who writes, "You used to have direct links to your documentaries, like the Big Oil series, the 9/11 series, and the World War series. How do I find these now?" Thank you, John. Yes, good question. And I know some people are always confused and intimidated by a new website, a new look. Well, it's been several months now. Hopefully you're used to it by now. But if not, this is CorbettReport.com. Here's the front page. This is what it looks like, right? There's this menu bar. It's confusing. There's a search bar. I don't know what to do with that. New start here. Log out. I don't know. Regenerative Agriculture Solutions Watch. So you have one video. I guess that's it. And you click on that, and that's how you use the web. Oh, wait. You can scroll down. I don't know if you've ever tried doing that, but it might be something you want to explore. Scrolling down. Recent posts. And you get to see the 6 most recent posts to the website. And scroll down below that. Oh, you can also cycle through older entries. Scroll down below that. There's the newsletter and the 3 most recent editions of the newsletter, and you can go through older entries there as well if you want. And if you scroll below that, documentaries! And yes, look at that. There are the Corbett Report documentaries, and you can use this arrow button over here to cycle through them. You can use these dots down below to cycle through them, or you can even just click and drag them to cycle through them. And there they are, all of the main Corbett Report documentaries. These are the main documentaries. I know there are other presentations like Brief History of Hopium or The Future of Food or How BlackRock Conquered the World, kind of podcastumentaries, but those aren't included here. These are the feature-length documentaries, most of which are available for purchase as DVD. Not all of them, but anyway. So here you go. Here are where the main feature of the documentaries, and I hope people appreciate that Brock put together some incredible-looking, really good movie posters, as it were, for these documentaries. So, and of course, with each of them, you can click into them, assuming it doesn't scroll away too quickly. I am going to guarantee you can click into these. There you go. You can click into 9/11 War Games, etc. Okay, so that's one way to find the documentaries. I think it's probably the easiest, most straightforward way, but maybe you don't like that. No, these images take too long to load. I don't like scrolling. It's too confusing. Okay, what happens if you type the word documentaries, plural, into the search bar and hit search? And, oh, look at that. Corbett Report documentaries is the very first thing that pops up. And if you click into that, you have a single page that has every single Corbett Report or all of the main Corbett Report documentaries listed reverse chronologically. And, of course, each one of these has not only the player, but also the various options for watching it on various sites, or downloading MP4, or MP3, or purchase a DVD copy, or the hyperlinked transcript. Here's the write-up about what the documentary is. So there you go. There's a one-stop shop for documentaries if you're interested in that. Anyway, explore the site a little. There's quite a few handy little features here that you may or may not know about, and scrolling sometimes is... Maybe you can explore and find new things that way. Okay, having said all of that, I think I'm going to stop now and recharge the batteries a bit. Thank you for your time and attention today. Thank you for sending the questions in. As always, you can send questions in. Of course, CorbettReport.com members can log in, and you can leave your question, for example, in the comment section of this edition of Questions for Corbett. You can really leave it anywhere. I will see the question at some point. Or if you're not a Corbett Report member, why not? Just click that membership there and sign up and help support this work. But anyway, you can always contact me through the contact form. I cannot guarantee I'm going to get back to it, each and every single person who ever writes in. But anyway, that's one way to send in a question. And who knows? Hopefully in the near future, there will be that question that sparks that thing that gets me started on an hour-long deep dive exploration. Who knows? Anyway, that's going to do it for this edition of Questions for Corbett. Thank you for your time and attention. I'm James Corbett of CorbettReport.com. Looking forward to talking to you again in the near future.